The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast.
Michael Brooks is the host of The Michael Brooks Show. He is also a future Zero Books author, with a book in the works on the intellectual dark web, and a regular guest on the Zero Books podcast. This week, Brooks returns to discuss the tragic, awful conspiracy that took Alex Jones off of YouPorn. It's Thursday, August 16th, 2018, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. We've started a Zero Books reading group for our patrons. It runs $15 a month on Patreon. And the first book on our list is Anselm Jappe's The Writing on the Wall. Support us on Patreon and join in reading Jappe's book and participate in an online discussion about The Writing on the Wall. All of our supporters get access to the Symptomatic Redness and Alternatives podcast, and patrons who donate $5 a month or higher get access to Inside Zero Books, the podcast, as well, which means they get access to a second podcast every week. Patreon supporters are helping us continue to produce our YouTube channel and our other online projects, like our online Capital Reading Group and like this podcast that you're listening to right now. The music you're listening to right now is a theme to The X-Files, but in just a moment, you'll be listening to Michael Brooks and I discuss the deplatforming of Alex Jones. All right, so we were going to talk today about Alex Jones and the tragedy of Alex Jones, the poor guy, getting banned from what really gets to me is that he was banned from YouPorn, which it cuts into my, you know, hobby.
Nice.
No, I'm confessing too much. I'm sharing too much. It's oversharing.
Yeah.
It's been all over the news. Of course, I made a video about it. And to be honest about it, I was going to do a video about the notion of progress anyhow. And then this happened to Alex Jones. And I thought, well, I got to get the clicks. So I'll put that in there. But what's your opinion about how people on the left should think about the banning of Alex Jones from Facebook and where else? YouTube and Apple, iTunes, and YouPorn, and a few other places, I guess, as well.
Well, I'll start by I'll sort of work from what I think is, I mean, they're all important points, but maybe sort of least important to most important. I know you and I might see this a little differently, but I'm really into, in these conversations, being really clear about, like, what actual censorship and suppression of free speech is. And, you know, this, particularly in the market economy we're in and how we do things, which, you know, I'll get to the ironies of that in a minute, is not, you know, Alex Jones not arrested. He's no government. No, you know, Obama fruit of security, Secret Service agents lent into his, you know, fruit of Islam. You know, he's broadcasting. People could still find his work. And he's not going to jail. And I think in general, there's been an incredible, you know, on the right, everywhere from like the dark web people to the Alex Jones people have made a lot of hay out of sort of endlessly going on about free speech and censorship while talking about it in ways that are incredibly loose and sloppy and definitely not legally coherent. Now, That said, yeah, we've created a modern, information ecosystem where a whole bunch of people's, journalism, commentary, including really important things. I mean, monitoring police misconduct is happening on a handful of essentially privatized commons, which we call these tech platforms, Facebook, Apple, Google. And, there's no question that this poses and already, in fact, influences and impacts a whole new generation of content. Let's just use that term. And, the third point I want to make is, there's been some kind of like eye rolling. Like we put out a clip on Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. I think it was something like, is Alex Jones the canary in the corporate coal mine, of censorship or something like that, or corporate censorship. And, a lot of people are, no, that's ridiculous. Like, obviously, even these companies can understand that Alex Jones does something different than, what the National Review does, right? Let's even just keep it just on the right. Okay. But that being said, they're missing a bigger point here. I mean, even a year ago, I believe it was when Facebook started tweaking algorithms to deal with like conspiracy content, it already had a big impact on lefty sites like Alternet. Now, I'm not, I'll confess, I'm not a regular reader of Alternet, but I know that, agree, disagree, whatever, Alternet, they might cover a story where they talk about, the CIA's relationship to heroin traffickers in Afghanistan as part of our ongoing, military engagement there. And according to a kind of generic algorithm or even just a hyper, sanitized editorial process, that could get put in the same bucket as some insane conspiracy theory or lie that Alex Jones is peddling. And I think that, people need to get, a lot more serious about that. One last example on Majority Report last week, our live stream was taken down. There was a strike against us as a channel for violating the community standards. And it was because of a obviously sarcastic anti-Chick-fil-A title from several years ago, something like "Hate a Gay, Eat a Processed Chicken." And the algorithm in its wisdom was not able to determine sarcasm. So, this Alex Jones thing, whether people on the left want to or not, whether they just want the individual victory or not, it does represent much bigger problems with these platforms. And of course, on the right, and all these idiots always freaking out about capitalism and everything else. Well, if you want Alex Jones back and you want to be, peddled colloidal silver and racism, well, you better support us in some form of socializing or at least trust busting the big four tech platforms, or there's no way we can have your free speech protected because they're private platforms. They can do what they want.
The thing I don't quite understand is how the media environment has changed because of the internet and what the responsibilities would be for, say, Facebook. Because there was a time in the 50s, say, when television was kind of a public resource and there were lots of different channels being broadcast by amateurs, and that ended and a few big corporations took over the airwaves and they had control over what was going to be seen on TV. We lived with that for a long time. They had every right to control what was on their network. And it wasn't considered to be a free speech issue, particularly even in the abstract, let alone, in legal terms, when that happened, although it was considered to be a struggle over the commons of the airwaves. So now we're living in a moment where there are these big platforms, but they have not been, because of the nature of the way the internet works, they just aren't the same kind of entities as a network for television, right? So they're much more open, and they also are legally protected in ways that television networks are not. you are NBC and you air someone saying this guy here is a crisis actor, or his kid wasn't really killed, he's an agent of the government, which is what Alex Jones said about victims, the survivors of the victims of the Sandy Hook massacre, you're going to be legally responsible for that person. They're going to sue, the families are going to sue you, NBC. And Facebook and Apple and these companies aren't legally liable, as far as I understand. And so their role, because of that, their role is different. They're not the same kind of companies. But what their responsibilities are to be an open platform, to be apolitical, say, which I don't think they have that responsibility exactly, is an open question. I'm not sure how to understand Facebook in that context.
Another irony of it is actually, this is where the destruction of net neutrality comes in, right? And Alex Jones actually, and I don't know. I don't know this, but I wouldn't be shocked if there was a period of time when the new guidelines were going to come in and AJPI was going to destroy, the open internet. And a lot of, right-wing talkers were doing a kind of like, net neutrality is just another word for communism kind of thing. And they were doing a lot of propaganda. And my suspicion usually goes to like some type of sort of, PR firms and indirect money from the companies like Verizon getting sloshed around. But, the irony is that, Alex Jones did his, anti-net neutrality propaganda, and he's actually maybe one of the first victims of it. Because that actually was, the bigger implications are, the real ownership regulation, as I say, either socializing or serious trust busting of these entities and serious regulation of them and understanding of them as, forms of public good. And it's funny, I would, whether it be they were socially owned or severely regulated, my instinct would be more like, regulate them and destroy the sort of corporate oversight of them so that they can continue to be relatively open and anarchic, right? Like, not so that they like television. Alex Jones, is definitely one of the first people, even as a consequence of getting rid of net neutrality, of these companies more clearly being in a position, not to say that this isn't directly because of net neutrality, because, net neutrality has to do with delivery speed and different types of levels of service, essentially, potentially with pay scales. But that being said, I do think it's a continuum of, ironically, the sort of corporate logic of the providers who want to build in a whole bunch of control and middleman fees. And then I think also, the understanding of the big tech companies in terms of like their concerns about essentially causing controversy in their content. And then, the pressures from Washington and the political process, which are not structural. They're, either crazy right wing people suggesting that, Google and Facebook are somehow products of like the left or something, or, a bunch of Democrats whose, big conclusion from 2016 was like, your Uncle Bob, voted for Trump because of a Facebook ad.
What is motivating Google and Facebook and Apple to move against Alex Jones right now? Is there something in the works where they're going to be held more liable for the content on their site? Are they trying to protect themselves in advance of a possible onslaught of litigation?
According to a report by Business Insider, while speaking to a joint session of United States Congress today, CEO Mark Zuckerberg took responsibility for the content on Facebook, rejecting a long-time policy in Silicon Valley that platforms aren't responsible for the content posted by users. Business Insider points out that now that Zuckerberg has publicly claimed that Facebook is responsible for the content posted to the social network, those policies will no longer be valid excuses for the platform's slow response to issues of hate speech, harassment, and misinformation on their services.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about litigation. That's an interesting question. I still would doubt legislation. I don't think that there's any type of serious regulatory appetite right now. But I do think what they're doing, it's funny on both ends. I mean, this is a thing that will, you know, is obviously like a kind of superficial sop, to the center left or whatever, or the center. And then on the other hand, you know, they're inviting in all sorts of right wingers to, you know, come in and consult with them and talk about them, about how they could be, you know, treated more fairly. I think it's just a kind of, I would think of this type of thing as more under the comms department's umbrella than the legal or legislative umbrella. Not to say that they're not all, you know, synchronized and working together, but
what I also want to mention is that I think this is a very interesting moment for the left broadly, from, like, let's say the Sanders supporting left all the way over to Marxists or anarchists, to take a position on this that makes sense and it isn't knee jerk. You know, like, I know a lot of so-called leftists who are sort of contrarian, who are quick to, like, defend the free speech rights of Alex Jones. I think that's a mistake. I think, like, it's not a matter of free speech in a technical sense, and his individual rights shouldn't be what we're concerned about. But what I do think we should be concerned about is what you mentioned, which is that we are living in an environment now where major corporations can control the flow of information on a system that's all about free flow of information. And, what our position should be about Alex Jones and about the Facebook and these institutions, I think needs to be really thought out rather than simply based on either a knee-jerk kind of free speech absolutism. I consider myself to be a free speech absolutist, but it shouldn't be a knee-jerk reaction, kind of a thoughtless reaction. And on the other hand, it shouldn't just be, oh, someone I don't like is suffering, therefore hooray, either. It needs to be somewhere in the middle or somewhere else altogether, really.
Yeah, I think you put it exactly right. And I actually think there is a kind of funny, and this is partially just a product of social media and our own just sort of innate predictability, but it's like when this happened, I won't use specific names, but everybody sort of had the response you'd expect, right? Like there was the resistance types were, you know, finally these companies are getting serious, and, you know, Alex Jones is a horrific evil. And also they didn't think also of the potential, like, you know, I don't know, but I mean, Alex Jones's website's still running. Like it, I think in the long run, him not being on these platforms is absolutely going to hurt him. But in the short run, I bet there is a boom in all of the numbers. And ironically, for his whole narrative structure, which is, you know, mostly fantasy, nonsense, bigotry, lies, and, you know, paranoia and everything else with great broadcasting ability, you know, now all of a sudden it's like, you know, his through how toxic and awful he is, he's created a version of his fantasy life becoming real, right? Like, of course, not for the reasons he says, like it's not the Chinese government didn't, you know, give the signal to Soros and, you know, now let's call it ad bullshit. But, you know, there are big major platforms saying you're gone, and that's going to feed his whole victim complex and, you know, the whole counter narrative and all the nonsense that he peddles to his gullible audience. On the flip side, yeah, I mean, I think there is this sort of like, you know, if people on our side of the equation completely skip. Like, I know for me, like, I'm as guilty of anybody of almost covering Alex Jones in a way that's like, I do think he's enormously entertaining. I, you know, I think he's an incredible broadcaster. I think his clips are really funny, and I don't, and maybe this speaks to my own, you know, everybody has their own sympathy for different devils at different times, but like, whereas, you know, for me, like, I don't, you know, somebody will mention some like, oh, but don't you think like, you know, Bret Stephens is trying to make a good faith conservative argument? I think Bret Stephens is total trash. I have no interest in him whatsoever. Alex Jones, it's like, yes, I get it. As a broadcaster, as an entertainer, you know, there's enormous talent there. And I've had to really remind myself, like, not only is this guy, you know, an absolute moral cretin, this has led to real stuff. Like, there was a story of a horrible story of a Black Lives Matter activist in Dallas becoming the subject of legal enforcement surveillance over a Facebook post that was taken out of context by InfoWars. So literally InfoWars misinformation has actually contributed to, you know, the actual surveillance and harassment of an activist in an actual gross violation of somebody's civil liberties, like in the real sense. So, you know, the guy is awful. And also even other things that we might glide over. Like, look, we don't, you know, part of the reason I might focus less honestly on my show on something like the smearing of the Sandy Hook parents is just because that's actually an area where, frankly, like, good. I think sort of liberals are covering that correctly, right? Like, it's a disgusting lie. And the parents, in fact, like, they should sue him probably, right? So that's a good thing. And I don't have much to add to that other than I hope they fucking clean him out because he's a scumbag and it's a disgusting thing to be lying about and spreading. So I guess my just sort of stance is I don't think there's any contradiction. I mean, I said on my show, like, you know, fuck Alex Jones. I don't like, there's nothing that I, you know, this is more analogous, I guess. And again, I still hate these comparisons because I think we need to be a little bit rigorous about these comparisons, but this to me is more analogous to the old ACLU, like, yeah, well, you know, we will defend, you know, I mean, Nazis, whatever, the most, you know, the worst people in our society, people that if they didn't exist, everything would be better. But we still see a broader implication at stake here. So we're going to make an intervention, but an intervention that should never be confused with sympathy, support, or anything of the kind.
Right. I agree with you. So the question here is what the effect of the ban will be on silencing Alex Jones. Or put it, you know, like, will his career be damaged? Will his reach be curtailed? And that's an open question. So that's the first thing you mentioned. And I think there's no doubt that in a certain way, this really hurts him deeply. Because, well, for instance, Richard Linklater put Alex Jones in two of his films. And, in very sympathetic ways in both times. In The Waking Life, Alex Jones was driving around a car, you know, screaming out of bullhorn or out of a PA system about, the basic dignity of humanity and the need to fight against the establishment and the corporate dominators and the people who are controlling our lives. Not, you know, no mention of George Soros or the Jews. That kind of support from someone who I don't really know Linklater's politics, but I would guess that he is, you know, a rebel more than he's a radical. So that kind of thing is not going to happen anymore for Alex Jones. He will not be held up by any countercultural rebel who isn't just absolutely on the right as anything anymore. He won't be getting placed in any more Richard Linklater films. And that also means that people who want to support him won't be able to pretend like they're anything other than far right people now. I think that has done his brand some damage in that direction.
I think that it already happens. I think this will only feed to it, but I could just tell you even just anecdotally, you know, I'm thinking of one friend specifically you know, who I've worked with on some things and who is just, you know, he's a conspiracy guy. I mean, not even about rebel versus radical. He's just in the conspiracy kind of matrix. And, you know, but, and I don't, and actually probably with, you know, more sort of general left sympathies and certainly totally opposed to the racism and sexism and anti-Semitism. But I think like, but also super, you know, much, you know, events are designed by hidden groups and, you know, crisis actors and that type of thing. And he had already quite some time ago been, you know, like thrown off that, like he had perceived that Alex Jones had been like kind of a, you know, kind of a loopy, kind of a showman, kind of a bullshit artist, but like in the realm of disseminating that type of information. And now he really thought of him more as like, oh no, he's a right wing talk show host. So I think especially in the age of Trump, Jones had already really, in terms of his own business strategies and just where the market is, had already made that jump. And I think from what I've looked at the Jones, a lot of that does go back to Obama, because I just think you can't feed that audience without the racial and religious paranoia about Obama. Yeah, I have. And that's what I'm saying. That I would definitely not describe it as left, but I could see that he was much, you know, he would strike me as more of a kind of very, and I haven't been to Austin, but I have a sense of Austin having a particular kind of counterculture and him kind of being a sort of Austin showman, I would say bullshit artist still, but not, you know, I mean, I read about him enough to know that like, he's reading John Birch stuff when he's a young man. So I, you know, that the right wing stuff is always very much there. But yes, during the Bush stuff era, I totally could see how people would perceive him as just sort of a, you know, an all purposes provocateur. But, you know, I also think there was a lot less. I mean, maybe there was also just less sort of general political literacy then as well. You know, I think like in today's environment, a lot more scrutiny of like, well, what exactly do you mean by that?
That the internet may have brought that on. But the other thing is, I think that if, say, Jeb Bush had gotten the nomination and won, that we would have seen Jones shift to attacking Jeb Bush along the same lines that he attacked his brother. Like, I don't think he would have gotten on board for Jeb.
Oh, I don't think he would have gotten on board for Jeb at all. But I do think that the environment is like, don't forget, like the mainstream right under Trump is just objectively far more publicly comfortable with expressions of xenophobia and racism. So under Bush, you know, I remember looking at that camp, like the whole point of Bush was like compassionate conservatism was going to be branded as the Republican equivalent of the third way. And the whole thing was George Bush, like, you go back and look at George Bush in 2000, like everybody kind of remembers the, you know, the Christianity and the cowboy swagger, but like, you know, he's speaking Spanish. He's taking as many pictures with, you know, young children of color as possible. They're really trying to brand, even in contrast to, you know, all of those Gingrich Republicans, which are quite a bit like Trump Republicans, that they really represent something different in terms of like at the very, not even substantively, but just like, hey, look, from the suburbs, you want a big tax cut. Your politics are pretty right wing, but you don't feel comfortable with like overt bigotry in the same way that I thought of it the other day when I saw this focus group of these Trump voters. And there was actually a split. It was a CNN focus group and it was really interesting because, you know, a large part of them were just, you know, exactly what you'd expect. Like, yes, of course I'm happy with him. He's doing what he promised to do. And I'm, you know, I'm glad to see kids being separated from their parents and all the rest. And then there were, but like there was one guy specifically, this middle-aged white guy who literally was like, you know, on one hand, it was comical because it's like how you could have watched Trump and not got that Trump is a bigot is, you know, hysterical. But for him, it was like, you know, Yeah, like, why is he calling LeBron racist? And why is he calling LeBron stupid? Like, he's racist. And I saw that guy and I was like, yeah, that's the guy that, you know, the Bush Republicans were talking to. So I think in that era, like, there might have been just a more general pool of people who weren't like, they were less in a mode of all of the racism and paranoia and just kind of in a more general, like, you know, sort of X-Files politics.
Well, I think that in the Bush Jr. era, that the left was more tolerant of Alex Jones's xenophobia and anti-Semitism and racism than they are now, because it was turned against their enemy, like the enemy of my enemy is my friend kind of situation. Like that, like I don't think he changed a bit. Like I think he was exactly the same during George Bush Jr.'s reign. But it played very differently when he was attacking the sitting Republican president on a regular basis than it does when he's supporting the bigot in chief today.
That makes sense. I think that makes a lot of sense, though, you know, and I also think that it's really, it's a good reminder too, if what you're saying is true, that just like, I really think, you know, conspiracy theories work for right-wing politics. They don't work for left-wing politics, because I think once you're getting into conspiracy culture, you're already sort of losing a systems critique and getting into like a very personalized sort of moralistic, simplified narrative of what's going on, which isn't to say, you know, it's delicate because it isn't to say that like conspiracies in the appropriate, like in the sense of the word that is actual, don't exist, right? Like corporations, you know, pollute rivers and then conspire to cover it up. You know, people, you know, their intelligence is hyped with their rock, you know, politicians lie and so on. But it's part of a broad, like, if you understand capital and those processes as driving things versus like, you know, when you reduce it to a bunch of people are sitting in a room manipulating and there isn't even like organic action anymore. It's just, you know, it's all been created. And in a way, it's very comforting, I think, for certain people because they don't have to deal with actually how chaotic and unsettling everything is. And then also, I think it, you know, that's also where that's usually the tripwire where people on the left fall into anti-Semitism, right? Is the conspiracy stuff. Because then when you literalize it, that's when the Jews come in.
Right. Right. Yeah, you need to figure out who's responsible for making all these decisions that are hurting working people, and you don't have any economic analysis at all. You don't understand what the demands of the current system are. So you just figure everything that happens, like let's say wages are falling. Well, that's someone's decision. They're doing that to hurt the working class directly.
Well, congratulations. I think also the other thing that's different now about Alex Jones, which is disturbing, but I think the other thing why the conspiracy culture is bad for the left is obviously it's totally, you know, there's no, I mean, this is an overused word, but literally there's no agency in it, right? Like there's nothing we can do to disrupt that kind of like perfectly planned metaphysical process. And that's why, like, you know, so much, you know, all the conspiracy culture is just, well, you sit on your computer and you figure it out. And maybe you can get into a really paranoid state by that by figuring out one of these secret agencies would kill you or something. But like, there's not even, I guess, you know, occasionally there's some protests, but there is not a real sense of doing anything. I mean, actually, Sam Cedar, you know, the chieftain over at Majority Report, you know, he did have a line. He said, you know, if Alex Jones didn't exist, the CIA would need to create him. It's like this processing of all of this, you know, rage just into like pure like impotence, right? And I think the other, but I think what's actually changing now is, well, you know, maybe under, I mean, I guess some of this was under Obama with all the stupid protests, you know, the Hitler and the Joker Obama and all that nonsense. But under Trump, it actually becomes a little bit more sinister because you can, because when you, you know, when he goes on those riffs about, you know, coming civil war or whatever, and he's whipping people up into all these states of paranoia and delusion and fantasy, now he's actually doing it informally, but not, you know, I mean, Trump's been on his show with, Trump went on Alex Jones' show when he was running for president in the primaries. Yes. I believe twice. So you have like this, like, you know, it's like now this correlates with the White House and with state power. And I'm not, you know, I'm not spelling anything specifically out by that. I don't know what that means, but I know it's different, right? Like, that's a different ball game now.
Well, the other thing is like in 2008, I'm sorry, like 2003, if Alex Jones is saying the globalists are coming for us, they're going to poison in the vaccines and they're going to poison the water and they want to turn your kids gay and, you know, they're going to destroy us all. They have a plan to depopulate the earth. They're going to kill us all. And what would that turn into? That would turn into buying some survival kit and maybe a bunch of canned goods, right? Yeah, I know it still does, but it also turns into, going out to, fight in the streets too. It gets frenzied, you know, you get into a frenzy about it and there are other groups out there, you know, like the Proud Boys and the Patriot Prayer people or whatever that will gladly take the Alex Jones fans and put them into battle. I mean, especially if you put it into there's going to be a civil war. So it goes much in a much more antisocial direction. Both are antisocial, but one's just sort of alienated and stupid. You know, you're in your bomb shelter. The other is, you know, you're out in the streets beating up your neighbor or the black kids down the street or something like that.
You wanted to overrun us and poison us and take our families and kill us? You will die, not us!
Exactly, because now it's gone from, you know, yeah, like, yeah, Obama and Google are making your kids gay or whatever. So buy colloidal silver and frozen food and all this other bullshit I'm selling. And now it's like, yeah, you got to do all of that. But then at the same time, like Trump is on the inside and he's fighting them. And, you know, he might need a fighting force, right? I mean, they always do the like, well, we're peaceful, blah, blah, blah. But I mean, I don't read that as anything other than, you know, literally being aware of like, you know, liabilities and incitement laws, right? Like the subtext of everything they're saying is pretty obvious.
Yeah. So what do you think about the fact that so much of the, because if you go a little bit more into the conspiracy realm, than even Alex Jones is in, you end up like dealing with people who are interested in the occult or, you know, who are interested in magic and things like that. And when I first started a podcast back in 2009, I started interviewing people who were interested in conspiracies and then also economists, right? And I slowly and surely stopped talking to people who were interested in conspiracies. But some of those people I talked to were, I don't want to call them lunatics, but I'll just say, cause they're not literally crazy, but they were just had a lot of crazy ideas. I would call them mystics. How about that? Who believed in extraterrestrials and, spirit and spirit realms and a conspiracy that was like conspiracies like Project Blue Book. Project Blue Beam is what it is. It's the one in which here's the greatest conspiracy ever. The government is going to stage a UFO invasion in order to justify taking control of the population, total control. And they'll do it so efficiently and effectively because they will have help from aliens. Do you follow? So they're going to stage a phony UFO invasion with the help from real aliens. That is, that's my favorite conspiracy theory. And it, by the way, it should have happened in 2012 or something. It should have already happened, I think. But, yeah. And that, you know, there are people who like, Alex Jones hung around with back in the 90s who believed that stuff. He came out of that sort of scene.
He said, I was at a public event being given an award, dressed as a transvestite, and Jesus is an alien. I mean, this was just, Jesus was being filmed with aliens, holograms. I mean, just lunatic, crazy. I mean, just lunatic nuts. I had no idea. And I was talking to Jason Burmis about this the other night. He goes, yeah, he went and printed it up, actually. In fact, get Jason's here. And I cleaned off the desk. Get him to print the passages where aliens filmed Jesus being crucified by the other aliens. I mean, folks, you know, if that... it's just so crazy to me that that's what COINTELPRO used to try to discredit me, is that guy who everybody I talked to said that you would call him up and he would just start screaming and cussing at you. And he was well known for that. And just so out of his mind that I don't think he was an agent, though. I think he was a complete lunatic.
What's going on, Mr. Cooper?
Hello.
Yeah, that's one of my friends just called in. He's got an Apache over his house with camera pods and infrared taking film. We're going to play that on our TV show. This is just wonderful. We get followed around by unmarked police cars, openly taking 35-millimeter photographs of us. That's just wonderful, isn't it?
Well, it's just one other manifestation of the Nazi Gestapo police state, which has taken over this country.
Again, I mean, I get on this program 6 days a week, and I know how you feel when I talk to you this week. And I'm 24 years old. I'm ready to just say, screw it. Because you got these people cramming cheeseburgers in their mouths, and they love it. I mean, doesn't it ever anger you?
Well, of course it does. What angers me most is the stupidity of the vast herd of American sheeple out there that think they know something, and they don't even know what planet they're on, to tell you the truth.
No, they don't. Simple things like private banks print the money and enslave everyone. Simple things like Clinton's a transnational agent.
I'll give you a kind of out there author that I used to read, although out there in a very different way. A guy named William Irwin Thompson was actually a proper, like, he was a professor at MIT, and so he had some other serious academic appointments. And in the early 70s, I want to say, he kind of was on track to sort of fill sort of like a Marshall McLuhan kind of role. Wrote on sort of like communications, global culture, countercultures, and cultural histories. And he created something called the Lindsvarn Foundation, which was a major counterculture epicenter. And he was a guy who definitely was very interested in synthesizing East-West psychology, did a lot of work actually in dialogue. He was an early sort of, you know, those conversations where the Dalai Lama will bring like proper scientists to Dharamsala and kind of bring like ideas from Buddhism, but like neuroscientists and physicists and biologists and dialogue. Have you heard of
that? Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I have a book that's kind of like that. It was about with Krishnamurti talking to a physicist as a dialogue.
I would say, yeah, it's in that kind of realm. Although it's interesting about Krishnamurti that always kind of struck me was that Krishnamurti really, in some ways, it seemed to me like he didn't kind of conflate truth claims, which was interesting. Like there was that kind of trend in the 70s that there was this book called The Tao of Physics. It was all like physics like validates Eastern ideas. It seemed to me like Krishnamurti was kind of interested in the overlap, but sort of like, what I'm talking about, like physics tomorrow could reverse and have a totally different kind of mechanical state, but it wouldn't kind of imply what I'm talking about, or contradict. But anyways, it's fascinating stuff. But the point is that William Irwin Thompson was of that world, probably helped create that world. But still was actually very much he was a literary critic, and even his more sort of new age books are still very much like, they're clearly the book of an academic, right? And in this one book he wrote in the 90s, I'm forgetting the name of it, but I read it a while ago, he addressed, I want to say Alexander Stitchin, I feel like his name could be, but apparently some guy who was, you know, writing some types of like, you know, I don't know, like, I think like a pyramid and aliens book and, you know, kind of like secret histories that are about, you know, secret societies and aliens and all this stuff. And William Irwin Thompson had a bunch of thoughts. And it was funny because William Irwin Thompson, for all of his, you know, very spiritual worldviews, was not writing about it like, oh, that's interesting, but I disagree. He was writing about it as a cultural critic. And I remember one of the things that leapt out at me was he was like, what's so amazing about so much of this sort of like conspiracy culture and secrets of the occult is how literalistic it is. Like, it makes extraordinary claims, but inside the claims, it's like, oh yeah, this diagram is a, like, what it really is a jetpack. Right. And like, what Thompson was saying is like, well, if you're going to sort of like blow your mind like that, why don't you contemplate that it's like, I don't know, a form of travel that you hadn't considered or something poetic or so, you know, something mythic that you had not considered before versus literally just like this whole crazy alternative history is just a literalization and a fantasy world of what we already know and experience.
Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
More interesting kind of read on it.
Like, if you get to the secret occult truth, it reads like a Marvel comic.
Right. That's what, well, that, I think he even made that joke precisely. Like, I think it was literally like something to that effect. Like, this is just sort of like adult comic books. And, you know, obviously the kind of materialist would just say, well, that's all just nonsense. And then, you know, someone like William Rowan Thompson might say like, I don't know. That's a Kundalini experience. There's this whole Indian literature on it, which is interesting, worth looking at and exploring. But it doesn't mean like, oh yeah, literally that was, you know, that how did the aliens fly here? They had Boeing.
Right. Well, that's, it's like, yeah. I mean, one of the things that this is an unjustified, unqualified, you know, non-expert opinion, but one of the reasons why Bible stories don't seem as silly as they are is because they're from such a different time. So nothing quite seems literal, right? But I mean, if you put those same stories into a modern context, they start to seem as hollow as they are. Does that make sense?
I would interpret it a little bit. I mean, I feel like there's actually like, I think you can either interpret those stories as, yeah, I mean, I think what you said, obviously there's a total validity in like, you know, I mean, but I have such trouble with, and I guess this does, I'm not going to get into it, but obviously this takes me, you know, this is part of the sort of conflict I have intellectually with some of the atheist scene. And I understand that there's a lot of people in the world who take these stories in a literal manner, and that causes an enormous amount of social and political damage. But that being said, I don't think that that's normally what's going on, even in religious communities. I really don't. I have met, including, you know, some very, very, very conservative followers of their religions who read stories in that highly literalistic manner. So I kind of find it, and that,
no, I agree. Most people, you know, are not literalist, and even those who claim to be often aren't.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's very difficult to have a literal interpretation of a fantastical story.
Right. Or, yeah. So, I mean, I find that it's like you're already kind of probably looking at it in the wrong way if you're just looking at it like, oh, well,
Oh, you're kind of faded out there.
I think if you look at them as a truth claim, it's just not really how those stories are working.
Yeah, and look, that brings us back to Alex Jones, because I don't think that a lot of what he is doing qualifies, and I think a lot of his audience doesn't take him literally either. What do you think?
Well, I wonder, I mean, that's really interesting. What's that? There's that kind of terminology of like, and I think it was, you know, it was in defense of Trump, and it was a kind of squirrely argument, but there was like this thing of like, the people who hate Trump took him literally but not seriously, and people love Trump took him seriously but not literally. Now, I don't agree. I think plenty of people took him literally, and I think that we need to be, again, just more real about the massive dangers of white identity politics and that type of thing and what it represents. And they took it literally. But that being said, I'm sure that there is a contingent that doesn't take it literally, but takes it seriously. Cause I'm assuming we're talking about people that are not, like, we're setting aside, like I've watched a fair amount of Alex Jones, and obviously it's pure, you know, millennial irony and, you know, comedy watching. So if we're stipulating that we're only talking about people that think he adds some value other than unintentional value, then I think probably there are a lot of people that don't take them absolutely literally. But then that kind of leads to an interesting question, which is like, and up your alley, which is like, if we take the idea that consciousness is as much at the effect of practice at anything else, let's not even say at the exclusion of ideation, but just the reality that, you know, it's not like you just walk around in this self-contained vessel and you have ideas and beliefs about the world and then you enact them. It's actually that you have ideas and beliefs about the world and then you go out and you engage in social spaces, and then there's all these giant feedback loops that impact your practices and then work their way back into your, you know, neurostructures and stories and everything else, right? So I think there might be a lot of going on in culture today from even the most, you know, even the most kind of sub pockets of the internet. Like, I think people, yeah, maybe they started like, oh, you know, that, like Angela Nagel identified that, right? Like, oh, this will trigger the libs. An hour, you know, a year later, that person might really be a fascist. There's people who, you know, they like the kind of like, oh, no, no. And I make jokes like this myself, right? But I'm pretty clear about that I'm joking. But, you know, I'm a Stalinist. I'm a full communist. But now you actually do see little pockets of, like, you know, attempts at revisionist histories. So I kind of wonder if, I mean, literally or not, the practice informs, right?
You say, oh, it's not, he's not true. It's not, what he's saying isn't exactly true, but it's true enough, you know, like, okay, so, you know, they're not turning the frogs gay because they're trying to develop a way to make, everyone gay, right? That's not the aim. There is no aim. Cause if you look at that story, it wasn't even that there was some sort of toxic chemical in some water that was, making the frogs, and other amphibians be, hermaphrodites. You know, they were no longer sexed. You'd have these frogs out, but both.
And this is obviously a thing about environmental pollution, right? It's about deregulated pollution. I mean, there's a book going back, I forget the name of it, but yeah, I mean, that's been very documented in terms of just the kind of general effect of people's hormones across the board by, you know, just air pollution.
Yeah. Right, right. So, yeah. So he would say that, he would take that, and then he would say they're putting chemicals in the water to turn the frickin' frogs gay, which is not what they were doing. And no one's, but then someone would say, well, I understand that they're not really doing that, but he's still right about the gay agenda.
Right. Which is actually the most crazy part of that comment. Right? Like that, that's what's funny to me is the line turning the frog. I think that's actually, you hit a really perfect example of that. Everybody reacts to that line because obviously you'd have to be completely addled and insane to take that literally. And we shouldn't discount. I'm sure a lot of people do take it literally who watch a show. Like, let's not be overly optimistic here, but it isn't like what he's, the bigger point he's making is actually way more toxic. Like, if he was saying it as like a stupid joke to make a point about air pollution, you'd go, well, that's kind of a weird
homophobic way of like identifying an actual problem. But what he's actually identifying is not the problem, which is air pollution. What he's identifying is there is this secret gay agenda, which is in fact, even if you were to say, I'm just catching the gist of that, well, that's actually the real crazy conspiracy theory he's promoting.
I don't like them putting chemicals in the water that turn the friggin' frogs gay. Do you understand that? Turn the friggin' frogs gay. Serious crap gay. Frogs, friggin' frogs. It's not funny. I'm gonna say it real slow for you. Gay. Frogs.
But I mean, but if you take someone who's screwed up and you want to hear me try to draw the chain of logic from that, here goes. Modernization. Well, fuck it. No, I'm not going to do it. Fuck it. But what I will say is that I can imagine someone being able to justify believing in the gay agenda based on that without them being just stupid or crazy. Like they would say something like, yeah, well, the chemicals are coming from toxins that they're putting out, but then the gay agenda is to try to normalize this so they don't have to change their practices and clean up the water. See,
yeah,
something like that.
But the guess in that is, I mean.
And then it's a hop and a skip to say, and besides, that's what they really want anyway. And then you're done. You know?
Again, he's not even going to want to acknowledge the environmental pollution in the same way. I guess he kind of does, but I don't know.
I don't see how you can report on that story and not to understand that this is pollution.
Well, I guess you could. Then you know what? Because then when you talk about the pollution, that's where and actually if you do play out that whole segment, that's just a transition to selling a health supplement.
Right.
So that's really going on.
Right. It's like, oh, the water's polluted. You don't want to become a hermaphrodite.
Right? That's what's really, really going on. There's actually, that's like the layers. Like, okay, I don't take him, cause that's how he's really suckering people, right?
Right.
It's like, okay, I don't take him, maybe I don't take him literally, but I'm actually buying into this whole conspiracy theory matrix through which the whole business model is a whole bunch of like, you know, incredibly shady supplement products to solve the conspiracy. And that still is at the end of the day, the prime. I know when people, the best that journalists could do to find his revenues, that's where the money's coming from.
Yeah. Yeah. That is a big, big hunk of the money for his, I mean, and especially in early days, that was where all of it was coming from. You know,
no, I actually think it's through, as I've read it, it's actually changed. He has gradually shifted from, I mean, I'm sure he still sells, you know, monthly memberships and stuff, but that the real focus of the business has almost entirely shifted to like, someone said it was like a conspiracy theory QVC. That's how they described it.
But didn't he start out on a right wing radio network that got their money from advertisers like that?
I mean, they all get money from advertisers like that.
Yeah.
They don't all own supplements.
These are InfoWar branded
supplements. Those are all InfoWar branded supplements. Generically, like, yeah, totally. They all have like, you know, gold, diet pills, you know, get rich quick schemes, definitely. But he has his own branded supplement company.
Wow. A lot of money. Yeah. I'm sure that is where he's getting the majority of his merchandising is everything. It's like Star Wars. The movies didn't make the money. It's the toys.
Exactly.
Right.
I mean, literally, like, yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. That's it. And then it's funny because then you're actually in the real, you know, then you're actually, you know, the real conspiracy is capitalism, right?
Right.
Like here, then it's like, okay, well, we've actually pulled it back here. And like, it's like everything else we see. It's like, all of the, you know, ignorance, paranoia, racism.
Would this be a bad time to mention that people should support my podcast by donating to Patreon?
No.
Perfect time, right?